talking a minute ago about the 1959 defense agreement with Iran, some of the concerns that led to it. What were the major Iranian interests?
I think that they simply felt that they were, the Shah felt that he was vulnerable to Soviet pressure and attack, and he wanted some assurance from the United States. Because of his being so close to the United States, and because of the oil agreement having been engineered by the United States, and being so much in U.S. interest, U.S. and English.
I
think that the political people at the time, so probably somebody like John Bowling would be a very good interview at that time. He's down in Alabama, I believe. He spent some time in Europe. He was political military officer and economic political officer at the time, I think.
Who were the major political officers at the embassy, the political figures that dealt with, you know, military and security affairs that you recall?
Charlie Spell was one, but he's dead. And Martin Hertz is also dead, but he was later. And in my time, it was Spell. And the, I believe that the...
You know Spell?
Yes, S-P-E-L-L-E.
Yeah.
The, DCM was at first was afraid that they're both the two DCMs who were there when I was there are both alive and living in Washington. One is Fraser Wilkins, and the other is Stuart Rockwell.
These are both. Was the first person?
Fraser Wilkins.
Was he under Eisenhower?
Yes.
And then Rockwell was under Kennedy and Johnson, I guess.
Rockwell may have come before the Kennedy changeover. I think maybe Wilkins was there for the first year and a half of my tour, and then Rockwell came.
So they were involved.
They both became ambassadors after that, and they're both now retired and live in Washington.
So they would have been involved in political discussions at some point?
I think so, yes. And the ambassadors are both dead.
Right.
That were in that situation, so they would know. And this CIA figure, I suppose, would know, too.
That was his name again? Was
Yatsevich.
I've read that during the course of 59, maybe early 60, there were either moves or discussions about moves to cultivate contacts with opposition figures in Iran. Did you hear anything about that?
Yeah, the Shah didn't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, any kind. It was not only that, it was whenever the embassy would seek to maintain contact of any kind with political opposition in Iran, even the most, what we considered was the most innocuous opposition, the Shah would complain. He'd call on the ambassador, or more likely, Yatsevich, and complain, and the word would come back that we would cut it out. The Shah took the position if we wanted to know anything about political affairs of Iran, he would tell us.
Was there, these efforts to cultivate or discuss, to help have discussions with opposition figures, were there, requests from Washington to do those sorts of things? Or
no, it was considered perfectly normal that any embassy, but naturally the government that an embassy represented would like to know what the political opposition was thinking.
Uh-huh.
So just as any embassy in Washington would talk to the Democrats.
So routine business,
basically. Yeah. Uh-huh. Now, there was certainly no effort that I knew about to try to phone in anything among opposition leaders.
But contacts still continue despite the Shah's objections?
I think that they would wax and wane.
Uh-huh.
I think that there was generally a willingness on our part to withdraw because we knew how much, very much in charge the Shah was, and it was very difficult to do anything without his consent.
Okay.
But the Shah was even then quite paranoid on subjects like that.
So he's got very excited about these kinds of contacts, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in terms of economic conditions, so when you were looking at economic affairs in Iran this period, well, what concerns did you and other officials have about economic conditions in Iran in the late 1950s? What were your major...
Our major concern was that the Iranian government was, economic management was spendthrift and kind of feckless. They were very slow to institute any kind of import controls. And when people got money, they could import anything they wanted to. The balance of payments turned very sharply against them. They seemed to think that having oil money, they could do anything they wanted to. They also were not very much concerned with general standard of living, but people who got money could just import anything they wanted to. And as a result, they were always going broke and they had to be bailed out. And we were trying to get them to institute rather more effective means of management, monetary control, and so forth. There was an IMF team that came over there at the time, sort of threw up their hands, and then they hired a very competent and renowned Belgian economist to monetary economist to set up a central bank for them. They never had a central bank before, like our Federal Reserve Bank, a man named Cracco, C-R-A-C-C-O, and he did that. But mostly we wanted them to manage their affairs better, to collect taxes so that they could run their country, to control their imports so that they wouldn't run out of foreign exchange, and that sort of thing.
Tourist into American foreign aid programs were designed to help solve these problems?
They were. You mean the technical assistance programs?
Yeah, I guess so.
The technical assistance programs were designed to do that, but what really happened was that aid came, financial aid had to come in the form of bailout. There was also some project assistance. We built dams for them and things like that under aid.
Was most of the aid just sort of like it was bailout, stuff like balance?
And most of it was bailout, yes, it really was. Yeah. Particularly the aid that came in at the time that Amini came in, because it was sort of like a payoff for letting a so-called liberal... I know that my office director, when I got back from Iran, to go to the Iran desk, was John Bowling, who had been a desk officer before me, and he disagreed with me on that. He claimed not to understand that, but I never understood Bowling, really. I thought that I don't know whether he was being swearing with me or not. He was this political officer, he was quite influential, and he was very, very pro-Shah, and tried very hard to keep our government backing the Shah, no matter what the Shah did. And a very strong-minded person, very persuasive person. He did not agree with me that we did everything on a bailout, particularly in favor of Amini, but I'm quite sure I'm right.
You know the upshot of the policy?
Yes, I do. I think that was the upshot.
What?
We had great hopes for Amini. Some of us who tended to think of him as the expression that he used, the Roosevelt of Iran. We thought that he was somebody who had a great deal of hope for the country. And he really did sort of spur along the reform movement. It was as if he appointed the Minister of Agriculture who actually instituted and implemented land reform, which nobody ever thought would be done. A man named Arsene Jani. It was almost as if I put it at the time that the Shah kept saying he wanted to have land reform, and I mean, he said, "Well, I hear you talking. Here's the man's left good." And he, and Arsene Jani had a brief and rather disastrous career as a result. It was a strange sort of time. We had a person who could really implement something, and he did. He was given his head because the Shah needed this kind of thing, but at the same time the Shah ran into trouble from the other elements who didn't like land reform. And then there was a token giveaway of the Shah's land itself to spur it, but in the end the Shah really didn't give away much of his wealth.
Can I just give me a question? How did you come to Americans' attention? What was the
basic,
like, press?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I think so, but I can't really say that for sure. I think Bowling would know a lot more about that than I. And even Noel Yasevich, as he were, if Yasevich remembers.
Was he in around 61?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But you don't recall
the late
pressure on Shaw?
I think there was, but I don't
know. All the details.
But I think there probably was.
Yeah. You were talking a few minutes ago about foreign aid programs. So they were mostly sort of a bailout.
That was my impression.
Yeah. Was there any kind of long-term view taken of how they try to apply aid to get certain...
Well, AID, the AID people were disturbed by this and wanted very much to do that, but they were sort of swept under by the thrust of American policy, and they objected to going along with this kind of approach. It's happened to many aid situations, but there was really no way of avoiding it, and they were not able to prevail against the thrust of American policy.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's not much really strategic thinking that was put
forward. Well, there was a lot of thinking, but it didn't make its way into policy. Yes, that often happens, the policy was rough and ready. And just had to become as in terms of bailouts. There's a person who was very, very close to some of the Iranians engaged in economic maneuvers of various kinds during that time, who was in the embassy. I don't know where what's become of him. He was economic development officer as well. His name was John Patrick Walsh. He was there in my time. He later became ambassador to Kuwait very briefly, and then left the service rather early on. But he, his insights into this kind of thing would probably be very helpful. I don't know where he is. I have no idea of his present whereabouts.
Was there much of a, I heard that the Iranians had a plan organization which they set up to administer their economic development plans?
Yes.
Was there much of a, there was much of a U.S. role on this, this
organization? The Harvard group.
This is the Harvard group,
yeah,
Harvard plan organization.
Yeah. Well, it was an advisory group, it was a plan organization, but it was an international group.
Okay.
I believe that the staff was, the officers on it were mostly, the technicians were mostly Americans. But the director after Ken Hansen was a Canadian named McLeod from Winnipeg, very good man. There's a man living in Washington now who might be willing to talk about that, who was on that group, named James Baldwin, who's now in the World Bank. I think Jim Baldwin, but his first name is really something else, like Charles or something, I don't know, some of these things, but he gets to be called Jim for some reason, I don't know, but I saw him not too long ago, so I know he's living in Washington. He was very good and very sharp on this kind of problem. And there was another one named Charles McNeely.
He's an advisor to the plan organization.
I think so. Then the deputy director of AID was a very, very knowledgeable person. He's now in Rome, the director of FAO. His name is Maurice Williams. He's very keen. He's done so many things since then. You may not remember little old Iran. He's been mission director in Pakistan and deputy director of AID and so forth and so on.
Now, I've read somewhere that the plan organization for some time was sort of autonomous from the Shah's influence.
I think that this was a fiction. I think it was it was on paper autonomous, but at that time really nothing went on in an official sense in Iran was autonomous of the Shah. He had a very tight hold on everything.
Yes. In terms of the foreign aid programs efforts, I've read that there was much concern in Congress in the late 1950s about the use of foreign aid funds in Iran, about the possible wastes of funds on projects, on project assistance and so forth, that the funds went to military budgets instead of to their designated purposes.
Well, I think there was concern like that in the Congress at all times. I think that person that would know a considerable amount about that, in addition to Phil Talbot, would be Jim Grant.
Well, who was he?
James Grant was one of the deputy assistant secretaries under Phil Talbot, and I believe he was concerned with this kind of thing to a very large extent, AA programs, and he is now the director of UNICEF in New York.
Is it AA programs?
AA programs. Yes, he's still around, and he's very, very sharp guy, very good.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that there was an IMF stabilization, IMF role.
Yes,
in
there was an IMF team that was sent out there.
How did they get, do you recall how they became interested in Iranian financial affairs?
Why they were brought in? Iran applied to the IMF for short-term dollars and payments assistance. The IMF said we won't do it unless you let us team come in with an economic with a financial stabilization program. So they accepted them.
The Iranians had to accept the plan as a condition for financial
aid. They had to accept the team coming in to try to put through an economic stabilization program. The team was headed by a very dour and cynical Dane. Named Elmholtz, who just did a very good deal of Iran and all the other, and not without reason.
Did Westland, were they successful, or did you work, were you involved in discussions?
Yes, I was. I was involved with them a lot. They were very successful.
They weren't?
No.
No. Because I read there was quite an inflation problem with this group. They're trying to get a bigger grain or monetary supply or something.
Yes.
But did it have much of an impact?
No. Not much more than our technical assistance efforts had. The thing about technical assistance efforts in the field of financial and economic management is, and this goes for India as well, where I was after Iran, is unless the country is really committed to something, no amount of foreign technical assistance is going to do any good. I think you could say the same thing about narcotics control as it's going on now. It's just, as a nation, we tend to delude ourselves greatly. The Iranians understood that the acceptance of technicians in this field was the price of financial aid that they were getting. They needed the financial aid desperately, so they accepted the financial assistance. Very cynical approach.
Well, the aid really didn't give that much leverage to those who were administering the aid programs
If they would have said, just think about it this way, if one of these people would have said, look, unless you implement the programs that we're teaching you about with our technical assistance, we won't give you the dollars anymore. And if they could abide by that, well and good. But the Iranians probably understood very well that we weren't going to let them go under. So the threat that you needed a parrot and a stick had any great...
You like playing a child to call a favor, right? Exactly. You just couldn't do that.
Yes, yeah. You just couldn't do it, and they knew that.
Yeah.
So, the undertaking was not a success in that regard.
I read that under the Kennedy administration, when Kennedy came in 61, that there was an interagency task force that made an extensive study of Iranian...
I think there was, that's right.
Did the embassy have any input in that respect?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
We did have some input.
Do you recall anything about the discussions in Tehran about what kind of recommendations to make to Washington in terms of alternative policies that were being considered, or is that anything?
I remember it fairly dimly. Yeah. I don't remember it in great detail.
So I recall that they were discussing alternatives like supporting military coup, supporting Mossadegh elements, supporting all support for the Shah.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that came into it. Was that in the documentation?
Yeah. They reviewed alternative policies and they said, let's go on. Let's go on with.
If I was involved in that, I really have forgotten the details.
Okay. We pretty much talked about the immediate thing to some extent, but what kind of. When Amini was brought in as Prime Minister in, say, May 61, I think, that was the date. Do you recall embassy officials had any specific idea of what they hoped Amini could or would accomplish? Besides, you mentioned land reform this morning. Were there other things that they hoped he could?
Financial reform in general.
Yeah.
And they hoped that he would also be able to bring some kind of order into the whole problem regarding Shah's fortune. This was a great problem. Even then, popular perceptions of it were such that it worried us as to the way people were talking about it. And we thought that the Shah should really put his fortunes out where everybody could understand them and do something with them. He never did, really. He always thought that he could solve the problem by putting up a shadow play of some kind about it. He always thought that he could, and this worried us a lot.
So land reform, financial reform, the question of Shah's fortune, were those the main thrusts that they hoped could be worked on?
Well, I think industrial development also.
Yeah.
We thought that the Shah should, and he felt quite strongly that he should diversify so that all of his financial prospects, economic prospects, wouldn't be in one industry.
Mm-hmm.
He always wanted to stop selling so much oil and develop the petrochemical industry, for instance, and do various other things.
That was discussed at that period?
Yes, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've read that Kennedy advisors like Walt Rostow had great interest in encouraging the growth of an urban-oriented middle class. An urban middle class
that's right.
Developing in developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
Is this kind of interest percolate down to the sea level?
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Yes, this is another thing that we hoped would happen.
Yeah.
We thought we saw some movement in that regard at the time of Shah's White Revolution, particularly his alliance with the Bazaaris and his...
What does that refer to?
Well, Made common cause with the bazaar people.
Bazaar, okay.
Yeah, bazaar, the bazaar merchants were, after all, the nucleus of the Dresdenville class in Iran. And they supported him, I think. They supported his reform program. There was a kind of a crisis in, I believe, August 1963, when the mullahs tried to stage a real revolt against the Shah's reform programs, particularly the emancipation of women. And there was a riot, there were riots in Tehran, and that was when the Bazaaris came to his support. That was also when Ayatollah Khomeini was exiled. We felt that the Shah won that one rather fundingly. And I felt, myself, that the Shah was on to a reform program that would really lead somewhere and modernize the country. I think I was a little premature in thinking that. Because what I was mainly not recognizing, what reckoning with, was the obscurantism and paranoia in the Shah's personality, which I think is the most unfortunate thing in this whole equation. I think and his complete subservience to his family, his inability to control his family, which I would really let him down the garden there.
I see.
In
terms of this interest, sort of modernization interest that officials had in the State Department and elsewhere, let me just drop that. That won't be part of the question. In terms of the efforts of the support of Amini in 61, 62, was there, do you recall, a clear idea of what this would mean in terms of Iranian politics over the long term? Did they see this effort to support Amini as a way to change internal politics
yes.
in Iran?
They felt that, this felt by our people, that if Amini prevailed, that it would be the beginning of perhaps a truly representative government in Iran, elections which people would credit as being open and free, and that the Shah would stop fearing the outcome of such a thing. The Shah feared that if Majlis elections were not strictly controlled, that the wrong kind of people would get in. And we wanted him to get over that. We wanted a truly representative form of government, or at least a more representative form of government in Iran.
Did you recall what the ambassador, I guess with the Holmes at this time, was discussing with the Shah possible, change in the political system?
I think he discussed it a lot, yes.
Yeah. That raised a lot of questions outlined in itself. How do you approach the Shah to get the change in the system? Would that require a very artful...
Yes. Julius Holmes is a very artful man. Yeah. And I think that he just... tried to persuade him that his regime would go down as the true modernizing regime, which is what the Shah wanted, and not endanger itself if it would reckon with the rising intellectual classes and the rising middle classes and give them the kind of enlightened government that they seem to want. And that this would release a productive element within the Iranian people, and it would be that's the way the Shah would really look out in history. The Shah was very conscious of his place in history, and it wasn't difficult to play upon that when trying to persuade him of something. If he could have been persuaded that his place in history would be more assured by an enlightened leadership than by repression, that would have been a great thing. And but he couldn't be. That was the point, and that was his downfall.
So was he so reluctant to go along with Amini?
Yeah. Oh yes, he wanted to assure his place in history by bringing Iran into the 20th century and bringing it into a enlightened form of government with him doing it all.
Without prominent prime ministers and so forth.
Yeah. Right.
Takes on the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Well, how smoothly would Amini was in power from, say, May 61 through, I think, August 62, summer 62, how smoothly did his reform efforts go, as you might agree? Do you recall much about
it seems to be doing all right. When did he get out in 62?
I think August 62.
62?
Yeah.
And Ali Mansour came in then?
I think so. Recall much about the happenings at that time?
I think the Shah, this is only a guess on
that
part,
but
I feel that the Shah was frightened by how far Khomeini was going and pulled back and got in essentially a non-entity, Ali Mansour, a toady. And he didn't want to play around anymore with a strong-minded man like Ali Khomeini. Mansour then was assassinated when, do you remember?
Now, I guess one thing that went on during the Kennedy administration, besides the efforts to support Khomeini as Prime Minister, was military. They reviewed military aid programs towards Iran in 62. There was a discussion of a 5-year military assistance plan.
Did you recall that? I don't recall too much about what that, I know that everybody who's had arms to sell was trying to sell this job because he was making money, the Brits and the French. And we had a lot of discussion with the Brits who resented our selling on certain things. But this was the kind of thing that the desk of the State Department could not, had very little control over.
So it was your Pentagon influence?
Yes, it was. I believe that, Julius Holmes was on our side. When he would have his visits here, he seemed to be, but in the end, he was not able to prevail against the Pentagon. And he also tended to repeat the Shah's arguments. I think he saw it as a practical matter. We just had to do it. The AIE people thought it was terrible. People didn't like financial bailouts at the same time as Shah was spending his own money on arms. This was anathema to them. I understand.
So they're restraining influence. They try to restrain.
Right.
Yeah.
You
need to talk to anyone.
Well, I think that there.
This is the second part of the interview on April 10th, 1985.
In late 1962, you became country desk chief for Iran at the State Department. What were your major duties there, in general terms?
At that time, the State Department had an organization somewhat different than it has now, in that the geographical bureaus were divided into offices, and each office divided into a desk. And the office I was in was the Office of Greek, Turkish, and Iranian Affairs, and I was the officer in charge of Iranian Affairs on the Iran desk. The present organization is for country directorates, and it's a rather higher set of organization, and one country directorate can cover several countries, more or less at the office level. As Iran desk officer, I was the first line of coverage for all relations with Iran from the State Department side, which meant that whatever came up, I was supposed to handle one way or the other with the help of whatever other United States government agency was involved, or with the consultation with my superiors and so forth.
Can you describe how policy on Iran was generally made? How strong a hand the State Department had in general policy towards Iran? Was it the leading agency?
At that point, the primacy of the State Department in the formation of foreign policy was being eroded from various sides. And I think this is very difficult to answer that question. The State Department still felt it would like to, and felt it would like to be at least a channel of all policy initiatives and approaches to Iran. But unfortunately, in not only Iran, in the case of many other countries, other agencies with overseas interests sometimes preempted the State Department's responsibilities in that field, and caused, in my opinion, a considerable amount of discoordination and appearance, or particular appearance to foreigners of discoordination. I think this got worse later. Later, I was deputy director of the India country director, and I thought at that time it was particularly bad. But even at the time, in the early 60s, I would not say that the State Department had the last word. There was, I don't think there was an NSC at that time. I can't recall whether there was or not. There was. Yes, in this case, the agencies with interest in any given country were supposed to coordinate those at the NSC level. Who was director of the NSC then?
Bundy was the advisor, security.
Who?
Bundy was Kennedy and Johnson's national security advisor.
So Bundy was in the same relationship that Kissinger was to Johnson. I remember dealing with one man on that NSC, a man named Comer, who later became ambassador to Turkey, Robert Comer, and he had a very high position on the NSC.
How strong interest did Rusk have in Iran at this time, you know, mid-60s?
My impression was not very strong. I think he felt that it was a country with which we needed to remain on fairly friendly terms, but I think he had a rather not supercilious exactly, but a rather diffident view toward Iran. He thought he expressed himself about the foreign minister, thought that he was something of a ninny. And I don't think he accorded it a very high place in his scheme of things. So that at the time when McNamara put pressure on him, for instance, to further arms sales, I don't think he resisted very strongly. I believe he was interested in a lot more other things in Iran. I don't think he took very seriously, for instance, the Shah's position, which he transmitted through his then ambassador, that he thought Iran should be appointed as our deputy to take charge of things in the area east of Suez as the British withdrew. I don't think he took that fairly seriously. Nor did I, must say. I thought that it was very early in the game of Iran's power projection to take on such a role. I thought that it was a position reflecting partly the Shah's own hubris and a certain ploy to make sure that he got the maximum in military assistance from us.
One major policy development during this period, 63, was the Shah's announcement of the White Revolution.
Yes.
Did this come as a surprise to U.S. government officials? Was there a prior consultation before the announcement?
No, there was no prior consultation. But we had the Shah, I think, he had two motivations, and I believe that we play a part in one of them. He wanted to impress us with his bona fides as a reformer, and two, he really had a very strong sense of history. He wanted to go down in history as a reforming monarch. He often said, and many people considered it a pipe dream type, in a pipe dream type of context, that he wanted to be the modernizing monarch, the monarch that brought Iran into the 20th century, that made it the equal of the most advanced European country. And he felt that with the oil revenues that he was receiving, that this was not impossible, and that he was the man to do it.
What was the initial reaction in Washington to his Shah's proclamations?
The White Revolution?
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to say Washington, because Washington was so divided on these things. I think that the well-wishers and admirers of Iran and people who thought the Shah was a pretty good ruler welcomed them with a lot of satisfaction. I think everybody else did too, but in many circles there was skepticism, such as in AID and in the Bureau of Budget with Kent Hansen. There was a feeling that the Shah was play-acting again. There was a lot of mistrust of the Shah and his motivations.
In March 63, President Kennedy asked for a review of policy towards Iran under NSAM 228. Now, to what extent was the White Revolution, or the announcement of the White Revolution, an impetus for this initiative?
I don't recall the connection between the two, if there was any. My recollection of the call for the Nissan is that it was generated by pressure from Ken Hansen, who was then in the Bureau of the Budget, and it was generated because he felt very strongly from his previous experience as head of the Harvard group in Iran, that the Shah was a malign influence on Iran and that our support for the Shah was a poor policy.
One declassified document associated with NSM 228 is called U.S. Strategy for Iran, Response to NSM 228. Did you prepare this document or help write it?
No, that was Ken Hansen's document. Completely. He was the author of it. I believe he's even so identified. I mentioned having worked with him for so long. I'm not quite clear from perusing it. I didn't It sounds like something that I might have formulated.
I bet you handed it.
Yes.
One of his basic points was that the Shaw should support that the U.S. should support the Shaw's reform efforts rather than directly try to intervene in his formulation.
Yes.
Just to keep it back a little bit. This,
yes.
Was this approach generally accepted by the NSC and Kennedy or higher level officials that the U.S. should sort of not try to directly intervene in the Shaw's efforts to
Well, I believe there was a strong school of thought in the NSC, represented mainly by Kim Hansen, which mistrusted the Shah so much that they felt that we should keep a tight rein on him. And if he said that he was going to undertake a reform initiative, that we should make sure that he really did it. That we should look with a very skeptical eye on everything he said and did. We in the state had a different point of view, namely that he was, for better or for worse, in charge of his country, that he had a very, he had a considerable amount of pride, and that he would not brook any kind of interference of the kind that some people recommended. So there was considerable difference of opinion on that subject.
Did people like, did Hansen's arguments have much influence on actual policy, on the outcome of
them? Hansen was a very influential man for the Kennedy family. And at the time of the Kennedy administration, there was considerable skepticism about the Shah and his intentions and his abilities and so forth.
Hmm. Well, the reply to NISM 228 suggests that there are some officials in Washington who were concerned about the extension of the land reform program during 63 that would frighten Iranian businessmen and disrupt food production.
That sounds like a CIA position.
Yeah. Were there any proposals to try to get the Shah to modify or slow down his land reform efforts? The response to the document that we have here suggests that there were some efforts to put forward a proposal to intervene in some ways. But that part is sanitized in the document. You can't tell what the proposal actually was or who was proposing it.
I can't recollect anything like that. I think that there was more concern on the part of people in the United States government like Ken Hansen that the Shah wouldn't go far enough with land reform, that it would be a shadow boxing and play acting and not a genuine movement. I don't recall any movement to slow it down. I think perhaps there was a CIA input into this Nissan reply, which may have made that point, but I don't remember that.
The report also suggested that a modest amount of intervention was to be considered. For example, efforts to ensure the land reform program operated in a rational or efficient way. Were there any efforts to convey to Iranians what land tenure arrangements would be considered rational or efficient?
I don't remember.
The report also suggested that the Shah should loosen up fiscal and credit policy. There was concern about a recession in 63, which they think the Shah and his people should loosen up credit supply and money supply to as a countercyclical measure to boost the economy. Was this
I don't remember that either. Okay. That sounds contrary to IMF policy.
Yeah.
But it may have been late enough that it was okay.
The response also suggested that discuss using military aid as a lever to influence resources allocation in Iran to prevent excessive military spending compared with the development assistance, efforts at home, using more resources for internal development efforts. Do you recall anything about this policy, or the multi-year, what's called the multi-year MAP plan, the MAP plan?
I remember that was a consideration, but that was, I believe that the State Department input, and particularly my own views, square very strongly with that. I myself was very concerned about the overemphasis on military spending on the part of the Shah, and I thought that there should be some way that we should not encourage that, and this brought me in direct conflict with the Department of Defense policy. I don't know if I mentioned last time that there was a very strong message that came over which suggested that we should get out of the way of the military sales policy, because I was at that time writing papers and developing positions which suggested that we should go easy on arms sales in order to keep the Shah from devoting too much resources to the military. And there was a phone call, I'm told, directly from McNamara to Russ, telling us that these people should get out of the way.
Was this more like a difference over whether there should be a limited arms sales or whether just how much they should be limited by?
The amount of the arms sales. I felt they should be strictly limited, and my assistant secretary, who was at that time, Phillips Galbraith, agreed with me, or said he did.
But were they people like us and McNair saying that there should be no restrictions at all on arms sales, or just a higher level would be allowed?
I can't remember whether they said no restrictions, but my impression was that if the Shah were willing to spend every cent of the money that we gave him as aid on shuffling resources, of course, on military sales, that they would have been quite happy with that. There seemed to be no conscience on that subject in the Defense Department, at least in my way of thinking.
So was there an assumption that the military aid, whether limited or excessive, was an important factor in stabilizing the situation in Iran, stabilizing the Shah's position?
It seems to me that the consideration was, one, the Shah wanted it and would be our good friend if he got it, and two, it would help our balance of payments. I think that was the only consideration. I don't think there was anything statesmanlike about the considerations there. I know that sounds like a very harsh judgment, but that is what it really things appeared to me.
Now, there's some nice questions about domestic policy developments in Iran during this period. Early in 1963, the National Front was pushing for free elections, but apparently Prime Minister Alam refused. Apparently the Shah refused also. Did the U.S. take any positions on this issue?
Did you say Prime Minister Alam?
Alam.
A-L-A.
He succeeded in the meeting.
Yes, that's right.
Alam. He refused free elections. Did the U.S. take any positions on this issue?
I don't recall if we did.
What was the general stance that people took towards the front, the National Front? On the State Department, what was the general view of these are sort of like the Mazdekas politicians?
We didn't think very much of them. Some of our academic advisors felt that we had dismissed them too casually, too easily, and also felt, as a matter of fact, that the whole 1953 episode had been a mistake, that we had thwarted a genuine nationalistic movement. But we found that we ourselves felt that the people representing National Front or residual National Front were extremely impractical type people and did not have the kind of support in the country that, say, Nasser had in Egypt when he overthrew the monarchy. This was a comparison that was often made, particularly by Manfred Halford, one of our chief academic critics.
All right.